Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk specifically about the Lend-Lease Agreement and President Roosevelt's Arsenals of Democracy speech. So we're really going to cover everything from 1940 through to 1941. And a good place to start is the presidential election of 1940, that Roosevelt wins that year against the Republican contender Wendell Willkie. Now, this was the beginnings of Roosevelt's third term in office. There was nothing constitutionally to say that he couldn't have a third term in office, but protocol and tradition established since Washington meant that presidents didn't do this. Roosevelt had seen America through two of his presidencies through the Great Depression, and now the spectre of world war was looming, not just for countries like Britain who were already fighting it, but for countries like America who were at that point far from impartial spectators. And the rationale of re-electing the president was really to stick with a figure who had already been seen as a safe pair of hands steering America through some very, very difficult waters. His opponent, Willkie, was a relative unknown and a surprise choice for the Republicans. He was a businessman who accused Roosevelt of failing to address the Great Depression. And in many ways, Willkie had plenty of justification. Unemployment hadn't significantly reduced by the end of the 1930s, and it was only really rearmament from 1940 and 1941 onwards that finally brings America to full prosperity again. Willkie was strongly isolationist, and whilst Roosevelt favoured intervention privately, there's no way he could have articulated those views to the public. Roosevelt had to navigate his way through the election, articulating a non-interventionist standpoint, and yet still retaining some freedom of movement for America for later on. In the event, Roosevelt wins a comfortable victory, and by December of that year, his tone has noticeably changed. In December, when he makes his normal, regular fireside chat, which are the broadcasts he'd made to America throughout the 1930s, to try to reinstall some kind of faith in government and some sense amongst the American people that the president cared and was concerned about them, he has a much, much darker message. When he made his famous Arsenals of Democracy speech, he wasn't really saying anything that American people hadn't already heard. Earlier on in that year, prominent journalists had begun to articulate that America had become an arsenal for the Democratic Allies, and that whilst Britain and the French were doing much of the fighting, America was supplying munitions, finances, and raw materials such as oil and foodstuffs. However, by December of 1940, the position has very much changed. France has fallen, and with the fall of France, a series of strategic disasters have taken place. Britain is now in bombing range of Germany. the British fight a desperate battle for the skies over their own country in the summer of 1940, and only really managed to save themselves by about October of that year. The question of the future of the Suez Canal is also hanging in the balance. Whilst the British throughout 1940 have spectacular successes against the Italians, Roosevelt is mindful of the fact that the British are overstretched and weak, and it would only take, for example, a crusading German Africa Corps, who are obviously transported to North Africa the following year, to seriously threaten the Suez Canal and Middle Eastern oil. To emphasise the gravity of the crisis, Roosevelt spoke in very clear terms. He said, "We face this new crisis, this new threat to our security of our nation, with the same courage and realism. Never before, since Jamestown and Plymouth Rock, has our American civilization been in such danger as now. For, on September the 27th, 1940, this year, by an agreement signed in Berlin, three powerful nations, two in Europe and one in Asia, joined themselves together in the threat that if the United States of America interfered with or blocked the expansion program of these three nations, a program aimed at world control, they would unite in ultimate action against the United States. The Nazi masters of Germany have made it clear that they intend not only to dominate all life and thought in their own country, but also to enslave the whole of Europe, and then to use these resources of Europe to dominate the rest of the world." This kind of rhetoric brought home to the American people specifically how vulnerable they were. A sense of invulnerability had existed in America following World War I because of the physical isolation of America, the fact that it is sandwiched between two oceans. Roosevelt makes the point in the speech that those days are over, that aircraft can reach America from Europe, and that the seas are not safe for American shipping either. Roosevelt in his speech didn't advocate that US soldiers be committed to the fight in Europe, but that that British soldiers continue the fighting themselves, but that they be backed wholeheartedly with American cooperation. Churchill was desperate for America to enter the fray, and Churchill dispatched various diplomats, agents and propagandists to Washington to try to sway public opinion in the direction of joining the fight. In 1937, the American government had signed into being the Neutrality Acts, which forbade American manufacturers from getting involved with either side of the conflict. These Neutrality Acts are watered down by 1939, when the cash and carry agreement with the British is signed. As long as the British pay cash for their armaments and then carry them from American shores with their own ships, then America can't be seen to be really taking sides. It's just an impartial tradesman. However, the Arsenals of Democracy speech really put it to the American people that America wasn't really impartial anymore, and that her cause was rather similar to the British cause, that democracy was threatened and therefore America herself was threatened. For the final step in the process towards war happens in 1941 with the Lend-Lease Agreement. The Lend-Lease deal is signed in March 1941, a good 9 months before America enters the war. And tellingly, it is officially titled "An Act to Further Promote the Defence of the United States." Clearly, American policy at this time was one of using material given to key allies to confront Nazism where and ever it may be, but not actually doing the fighting themselves. Hitler pretty much completely interpreted the Lend-Lease Agreement as an act of war, and from that moment onwards saw the clock ticking towards war with America. Hitler had, in his various works, suggested that a war with America would be inevitable eventually, but Hitler had a clear timetable for this. Hitler did not intend really for war to break out with America until Russia had been fully conquered. However, we've got to take what Hitler writes with a pinch of salt. When he writes books like Mein Kampf and Die Schweizbuch afterwards, really, you are interpreting the wishes and dreams of someone who never really liked reality to intrude upon his plans. America, by this point, had already begun mobilising for war. It had its very own peacetime draft, and it had started mass war production anyway. And it's interesting that part of the Lend-Lease Agreement is devoted not just to helping Britain, but also to helping Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist China to stand up against the Japanese, another country that America isn't as of yet at war with. In 1940 also, the British and the Americans had signed a Destroyers for Bases agreement, where 50 rather dilapidated destroyers from the USA, which turned out to be, in some instances, more trouble than they were worth to the Royal Navy, were swapped for bases in the Caribbean that the Americans could use. When the Lend-Lease Agreement was signed in America, there was broad support for it. But again, because there was the feeling that it would keep America out of the war, that the British would be doing the fighting and that they would be trading equipment for security. Now, if we're evaluating the long-term significance of all of this, you can probably boil it down to a few key points. Firstly, the British now had an unlimited line of credit provided by the Americans, and by 1943, pretty much one quarter of all the equipment that the British had, particularly transport aircraft, had come from the United States. The United States were producing aircraft at something like the rate of one every 50 minutes from a production line. And bear in mind, Boeing had production lines, and Lockheed and other manufacturers had production lines, hundreds of production lines up and down the country. In many ways, World War II was the ultimate war of production, and having the productive power of the USA behind the British is one of the key factors that enables Britain to continue fighting, and then obviously the USA to join in the fight fairly shortly afterwards. After July 1941, the Soviet Union is also the recipient of this aid. And amazingly, at the Tehran Conference in 1943, Joseph Stalin acknowledged publicly that without US war production, the war would have been lost. I think perhaps a more cynical way of looking at it was the way in which Senator Robert Taft of Roosevelt's administration put it. He said, "Lending war material is very much like lending chewing gum. You don't want it back." The Lend-Lease Agreement was abruptly cancelled in August 1945, following the end of the war, and it was something that would leave the British with enormous financial dilemmas ever since. The British were rather hoping for a kind of a friendly loan, or indeed grant of aid at the end of the war, which would reflect the fighting that they did from September 1939 to December 1941. They were to be sorely disappointed, and the future viability of Britain was deeply rocked in 1945 and 1946. But that, as they say, is another story. Anyway, if you'd like to know a bit more about this, visit my site. It is www.explaininghistory.com. We've got a newsletter there. I'll be putting something out about the Lend-Lease Agreements fairly shortly. You can sign up to this podcast every week. And there will be some exciting developments coming soon with the Explaining History online learning portal, which is on the way, but more about that later. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next podcast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.